Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. As we said last week, we're going to be on Thursdays learning something different than on Tuesdays, and we are going to be doing a continuation of what we did in the past series of Bible building blocks on the Book of Bereishis. So we're going to now focus on the Book of Shemos, and we're dealing with the concept of from exile to redemption. So that's what we're going to do on Thursdays. Tuesdays we'll continue with the Rambam, and Thursdays we'll do that. And last week we began, and last week we did basically an overview of the entire book. So if you weren't here last week, it's ready on the website. You only have to make up one class. And that is the, if you look at the double-sided sheet that you have, the side that says Book of Shemos Overview. Oh, you had it right. Book of Shemos Overview on the top. We went through the 11 books, and we explained the flow of the Book of Shemos. We also explained how the holiday cycle follows through that. And then we just, in the last end of the class, we discussed the theme of the Book of Shemos and how it began with the opening verses of the Parsha, which if you look on the other side of the sheet that you have, finally the other side, we looked a little bit at the first verse in Shemos, correlated that to a verse in Bereishis, and we explained the overall theme of the Book of Shemos through that. And just again to repeat for those who weren't there, basically we're talking about the Book of Bereishis is the Jewish people as a patriarchal society and the Book of Shemos a nationalistic society. We deal with the Jewish people as a nation, and we said, and that is the purpose of creation. The purpose of creation is to have a nation that wants to have a relationship with Hashem. So it's interesting. There are those rabbis who call the Book of Shemos like Book 2 of Bereishis, like Bereishis Part 2. In other words, Part 1 dealt with everything dealing with individuals, patriarchs. Part 2 is now taking everything but doing it on a nationalistic level and creating a nation with these same building blocks, which is a much more complex and difficult task, but much more rewarding. Because as a nation, you can have a Torah. As a nation, you can change the rest of the world. As a nation, you can have a Beis HaMikdash where the whole world will focus on. And that's what the Book of Shemos is dealing with. And, of course, when you become a nation, your posture changes. If you're an individual, you can hide in a corner and not have to deal with the rest of the world. You want to just go and move to a remote location somewhere in Ontario near the cornfields, face the wheat fields in Manitoba, and just set up your own little home and be a Jew. You could do that, and you can relatively not have to deal with anybody else. And you may even be successful to a certain degree, but you'll be a miserable failure is that you didn't connect to the rest of the world. And you were isolated, totally isolated. And so there's an upside and a downside. Upside, no one's bothering me. Wouldn't it be nice? 10 of us would move to a remote place and take a nice place, you know, somewhere in Arizona. And there's lots of empty land in Arizona. And just take a few 30, 40 acres of land, probably even 100 acres of land, and put up our 10 houses and build our own country club and everything we have and just live our own little life. That would be a very nice thing, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be very nice? And once a week we go into town just to pick up the supplies, send someone to buy the supplies. We have nothing to do with the non-Jews of the world, and we don't have to worry about their influence. And we're nice Jews. And that is a nice thing on the one hand, and that has an upside. The downside is we don't accomplish anything. There's a bigger purpose. The whole idea is, as it says in the Aleinu, we wait for that day that Hashem Echadu Shemocha, the whole world, is supposed to acknowledge God. And that is the role of the Jewish people. We have a double role. A, as a nation, to serve Hashem. And then to take that beautiful concept and share that with the rest of the world, and that the whole world will acknowledge this understanding of God in this world. Right? The patriarchs were focused more on developing themselves and, you know, whatever circle they were involved with. Avram certainly wasn't in his own world. Yisrael and Yaakov were in their whole world. But there's only so much individuals can do. An individual can, no matter how universal your focus, an individual can only do so much. A nation can do a lot. And that's the challenges that the Book of Shmos describes. And therefore, there is a change is going to happen in the Book of Shmos. A real change is happening now, because to this being a nation will require a lot of preparation, a lot of work, and also a lot of dealing with the non-Jewish world. And therefore, change, you know, we were just at the Age Up conference, and they're talking about changing paradigms, in terms of outreach. And, one of the rabbis there was discussing the idea that a human being and a nation and history, there always has to be change. There can not be such a thing as things staying status quo forever. It can't be. You know, you get more people. Life demands changes happen, and you have to respond to the changes, and you can't do the same thing all the time. Even if you're a Torah observant Jew, and the Torah says that, you know, here's the 613 mitzvahs. So what do we don't, you still have to change. They're not changing the corpus of Torah, not changing the ideology of Torah, but changing the sensible application of the Torah. And some generations you have to focus more on prayer, let's say, but not to say that we don't learn Torah, chas v'shalom. And in some generations we have to focus more on Torah, but doesn't mean to say we don't pray with intensity. And sometimes you have to focus more on kindness. So you have to shift the focus, but you're not changing the overall structure of Torah. It's focusing on a different floor, different area, different energies. And you have to be able to adapt. So as times change, the Torah doesn't change, the Jewish people don't change in our mission statement, but the sensible application of this has to change as generations change. And therefore, when we're dealing with the Book of Shmos, like a major change is happening. The way Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov and their children, they lived one kind of life, and it was very good kind of life, and they were struggling with developing these new spheres. You know, the whole idea, as we learned in Bereishis, to develop the concept of kindness in a world that didn't have any, to develop the concept of control and truth and mercy and all these things in a world that didn't have it. That was a tremendous thing that they gave us in the Book of Bereishis. But now we have to develop concepts of unity within a nation. We have to develop concepts of how do we will have our faces mixing with the non-Jews of the world in a very big way. We are going to take on a Torah whose mission is for us to be a light unto nations. So that means there's going to be a change happening to the Jewish people, and they have to be able to respond properly to the change. And just like the patriarchs struggled and made errors in learning, they're learning errors, and those are good errors. Those are errors where you're trying to do things and you're making mistakes and you learn from your mistakes. We saw in Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they all had failures in their growing process and ultimately succeeded. And the brothers had failures of how to deal with each other. However, unfortunately, they didn't ultimately and totally succeed. They didn't ultimately and totally succeed. And that will carry over into the Book of Shmos. Now we're going to have a whole nation evolving, and we're going to see the struggles that are involved. The struggle of the change of becoming a nation while in the exile, and then coming out of the exile, and there's a lot of change that happens, and there's a lot of struggle that happens. So, and this is what we have to be talking about in this book. Now, just one other idea that goes along with this. The Sefer is called Sefer Shmos. The Book of Shmos. Now, what does the word Shmos mean?
Names.
The word Shem is a name, Shmos are names. And it seems kind of, random that the whole book is called after a verse that says, and these are the names of Yaakov's sons who went down to Egypt, and they list the 12 names, and now the whole rest of the book, the rest, 11 parshios, has to do with names. So, it's the same idea. Because you know the concept of a name, we've said it many times, the concept of a name means, the name defines what your spiritual talents are, what your purpose is as an individual, and if you will, and your challenge is to live up to that name. You know, we don't realize this, but every name that we have, you know, the rabbis say when you name a child with a Hebrew name, you get a little bit of a slight taste of prophecy. When you name your child a certain Hebrew name, mystically, a name either through its gematria, through its numerical value, the positioning of the letters, whatever, it will define what strengths lie in this child, what potential is in this child, and then it gives you a focus of what to fulfill in that life. That's the whole idea of a name. A name is a very deep concept. It's not just, oh, it sounds like a pretty, pretty name. The name of the year is, you know, whatever, Brittany. You know, everybody's called Brittany, so I want, it sounds nice, I'm gonna call my kid Brittany. You know, every Tufa has the cool names. You could, a lot of times you can tell by the name of a person what era they lived in. You know, and in the Jewish people it's also true because they had Yiddish names and things. So we have names, and these names are to reflect our purpose and our mission. It's interesting, though, that purposes change also within the context of the strength that you are in. The Medrash says, we know Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, they all had names and they were for particular reasons when they were born. You know, Reuven, Hashem saw my pain and therefore he gave me a child. So Reuven is the kind of a person who's going to work on trying to alleviate pain, and therefore he said Reuven brought flowers to his mother so she wouldn't feel the pain. That was the kind of nature they had. If you have a chance to look at the Midrash here, it calls the 12 sons and it uses all different interpretations with that same root. You know, Levi. Levi is like to connect, means to connect. So Leah said, hopefully my child will connect me and my husband together. Now that I have three children, my husband will like me better. Right? So, but then, you know, but here Levi is that he connected the Jewish people to Hashem. So there's a little shift in the mission. Although the idea of Levi is the ability to connect people. That's what it means. If you are a Levi, your whole essence is to connect different entities. That's what a Levi is all about. So when you're a patriarchal society, you use that skill to connect a father and a mother. When you're in a nationalistic society, you have to use that skill to connect a people to its God. So you have to change within the context of your skill base. And that's the real challenge in a name. Real challenge in a name is to be able to change when from the status quo. That is what having a name is all about. A name means these are my qualities, but you don't sit with this and do this one thing your whole life. This is the one thing I'm good at, I do it my whole life. It means that you have to be able to take that quality and apply it appropriately in different situations where you'll have that strength, but now you're going to do something different that you're not used to doing. And you have to do it, and there's going to be struggles now. And people are resistant to change. When the Torah says, for example, in last Sefer Bereishis, it says these are the names of the children of Yaakov. It says the 12 children, and then it lists the next 58 children and grandchildren that came out of that. It lists all 70 in the book of Ayikar. In Sefer Shmos says, these are the children of Yaakov. It says just the 12. It doesn't talk about the others. So the rabbis say, why? Because those 12, the tribes, they made the successful transition of adapting their name to different situations in life. The 12 did. Their children and grandchildren were not as successful. We could speculate on why. I don't want to get into that so much. They were still alive when Yaakov was around. They were closer to Yaakov. They were raised, lived longer in Eretz Yisrael. It can give all kinds of reasons. But the bottom line is, the Torah is saying, those 12, these are the 12, and they remained. And they're able to shift and adapt and remain true to who they were. And when they came into Mitzrayim, they realized we're in a foreign land and we now are going to have some kind of relationship with these people, but we have to ensure that we don't compromise in who and what we are. And they lived up to that potential. I say a little pun on this. You know, you look at the English, how we spell the word, you know, S-H-M-O-S. You know, it's a pun, right? It's, what does that say? Schmoes. A schmo. The plural of one schmo is many schmoes. Schmoes. You know, so you could either be a schmo, but the truth of the matter is, you know, if you look at even the Hebrew letter, shin mem vav, schmo. But really that shva, that two dots, is a shva na. The proper word is shimo. Shimos. And it's not schmoes. So, you know, if you fail to live up to your real name, you'll talk, it'll be a schmo. But if you can live up to what the challenges are required, that's Shimos. That's the name. And that is really a person with a name. The Shalach HaKadosh says, the Shalach HaKadosh, the Holy Shalach says, that at the end of the Shmon Esrei, before you take your steps back, and send the Arab scroll sitter, you should say a pasuk of the Torah, that the first letter of the pasuk is the first letter of your Hebrew name, and the last letter is the last letter of your Hebrew name. You look in the article, so you'll see the back, and say that pasuk. And he says that's a great segul, it's a great charm, that on the day of judgment, when it comes, and God asks you your name, that you won't forget your name. That's what he says. So the commentators try to understand, what does he mean? What do you mean, I'm going to forget my name? Can you imagine when you're up in Shemayim? What's your name? you know your name. You're so scared, you're so nervous, you're before the throne of glory, you can't remember your name. But based on what we're saying, it makes a lot of sense. God, when you go up there, God's going to say one thing. Do you know your name? Did you know your mission? Before we even judge you, did you know what you were here for? Did you know what your goal was in this lifetime? And you go, oh, do you know your name? I was here to have a lot of fun. I was here to be a good Jew. Yeah. So what does that mean, being a good Jew? How are you a good Jew, but different than that good Jew, and different than that good Jew? I don't know. So we're all the same. And then, oh, it's not going to be good for you. It's not going to be good for you. But if you go up and say, oh, I know that my mission when I was 20 to 30 was this. I'm just saying, averaging out. And then when I got married, my mission shifted a little bit. And then when I became a grandfather, it shifted a little more. When I became older and I got involved in the community, my shift was like this and my shift was like that. And therefore, everything I did followed that. So how are you going to remember that name? So say that pasuk. There's a pasuk that has the first letter of your name and the last letter of your name. And if you really would understand deeply what that pasuk means, you'd understand your mission. And a person, it's not only from the pasuk, obviously. It's a lot of mysticism here. But to know who are you? And that name defines who you are. And therefore, the book of Shmos that's going through this critical transition, we have to always remember our name. What's my mission? What's my goal? Especially when you're creating a nation now. You have to know everyone has to know where they fit into the puzzle over here. And perhaps you could say, this is the deeper understanding, it says, the Jews who merited to leave Egypt, they were very careful in three things. And one of them was they didn't change their name. What does it mean they didn't change their name? So simple meaning is, you're in Mitzrayim, your name was Moshe, Chves, so, you know, you didn't change it to Mark. You know, or Mortimer, or whatever, you know. And I don't know what the Egyptian names would be close to that, you know. You know, whatever the Egyptians' names are, you kept your Jewish name?
Anwar.
Right? Anwar. Right? Instead of Avraham, you're Anwar. Right? So, so that's on one level is true. But a deeper level is they didn't change their mission. The mission was what? To bring God into this world. That's our mission. And each one has a unique role to play within the context of that nationhood. And they didn't change their names. Unfortunately, many did. And those are the ones who couldn't leave. Now, a good sign of that is, it's a sign, not a proof, you keep your Hebrew name. If you live in North America, you know, when everybody's called Sam and Joe and Pete and Fred and Mark and Susan and Mary, and you want to have their name, that could very well be reflecting you want to be like them. and you're not worrying about your mission. And that's why this book of Shmos keep talking about our names. There's so much talk about names. The first parsha, there's so many names. So many names. Why? Because keep your eye on the ball. What's your mission? If you keep your mission, you'll be able to succeed and thrive. And if not, unfortunately, bad things are going to happen when you try to be like the non-Jews, as we're going to talk about in this class. All right, so that's just a little bit more over in it. Did you have a question or just was no, that statement you wanted to say? Good. Oh, good, Baruch Hashem. Husband and wife think alike. Baruch Hashem. Okay, so let's look at some of these themes over here. We're gonna go back over last week's parsha because we're not gonna be able to keep week by week. On Shabbos, I'll be forced to when I do it, but here you're gonna get the more detailed, and we'll probably take more than 10 classes to get through Shmos properly over here. So if we look at, I listed the 12 main things that happened in this week's parsha, in last week's parsha, in Shmos. Number one, the generation of Yosef and his brothers pass on, they die. The Jews begin to assimilate. And just in terms of the years, the chronology, just always keep that in mind. Remember, I said it last week, I'll say it again, because everybody's here this week. Simple numbers to remember. You don't have to, I'm not big on remembering 1,000 numbers of history, but basic numbers every Jew needs to know, right? So what's the number I expect everybody to know that the year Avram was born is what? 1948 to the year of creation. All right? You can remember, that's the easy one to remember, 1948. Birth of the State of Israel in the secular calendar, 1948. Birth of Avram in the Jewish calendar, 1948. That's an easy one to remember. There's no reason why you can't remember. Just have a sense of history. When you speak to a non-Jew, when did Abraham live? I don't know, a few thousand years. You say exactly. You know, our calendar is 5,767, and 1948, do the math, 3,800 years ago. Whatever, 3,800 years ago. That's not even live. Finished. B.C., it's whatever, 1800 B.C., whatever. Just know, right? 1948. He was 100 years old when he gave birth to Isaac. It's easy to remember. It's easy. I'm not taking the tricky ones. At the year 2048, Isaac was born. And from Yitzhak's birth till we got out of Egypt was 400 years. 2448. That's all the numbers you got to remember. That's easy to remember. 1948, when Avram's born. 500 years later, the Jewish people get out of Egypt. 2448. And that's a year every Jew should know. You know why? Ask an American. Any American. Declaration of Independence. What year? 1876. No, you're not an American. Canadians don't know.
What's the question?
Declaration of Independence. United States. When did the country become a country? You ask any American, they know. If you don't know, you're Canadian, so you have an excuse.
1776.
You're only 100 years off.
1776.
1776. There's not an American who goes to school as a notice. Now, I don't know. Canadian, we're going to... When did Canada become... I don't know what they call Canada.
Federation.
A federation. What year? What's the year of federation? What? What's the year? It's a Shanda. Well, there's no real Canadians here, really. You guys all... Well, you're a Canadian, so shame on you and shame on Gail. And Pauline, you're... Okay, but nothing bad on you. But unfortunately, Canada doesn't have such a glorious history like America had. So you know, how could it be? You went in a Canadian school. You don't know it. But I'm not saying it's you. I'm just saying. So whatever it is, I don't know what it is. 80 something. So here's the wrap. How could it be a Jew doesn't know when the Jews became? How could it be?
Because it's not taught, that's why.
So that's what we're teaching it. You can go to most Orthodox Jews, they won't know this. They go, it's around you. No, it's between Avram and Yeshua. But that's the problem. That's the first problem. When you live with two different calendars, that's already the first problem. As a Jew in exile, fine, you know it's 2007, right? But as a Jew, you have to know it's 5,767. That's the first day. You have to know that because you're counting towards Mashiach. You know there's only 6,000 years to this world. So you gotta know it's 5,067. You gotta know that. How long have we been, Goy asks, oh, David, you're Jewish, how long have you been around? So when he goes, a long time. thousands of years. Well, don't you know when, around you? No, maybe 2,000, maybe 5,000, maybe 8,000, maybe no, those 8,000. You know, it's all clear. 2448. That is a watershed year in world history. 2448. A watershed year in world history. It was the year that changed the world. And it's in the Book of Shemos. How am I going to remember that? So I told you, you all know 1948. You all know 1948.
Yeah. And add 500.
And just add 500.
24
yeah, you yeah. Double what? 24 is doubled to 48. 24 doubled is 48. 24 and 24 is 48. And once you know these numbers, then when you learn other parts of history, it gets easier. You can know when we entered the land of Israel and when the temple was destroyed. They all flow from each other if you know these building blocks. Certain key seminal events, you know, like I said, the Mabul, 1656. I mean, you have to know, 1656, important year. The deluge, 1656.
1066.
What's 1656?
What's 1066?
Nothing. I don't know.
Battle of Hastings.
Okay. Battle of Hastings, great. But I'm saying, that's what this book is focused on, as we said last week, a very short period of time. So what happens? So if you look at number one, so the year 2238, Yaakov descends to Egypt with 70 souls. In the year 2309, Yosef dies. Levi dies in 2331. That's the last of the children of Yaakov. 2331. Okay. Now, so you know, so, and at 2332, the Egyptian bondage begins. That's when the slavery begins. We just should know, you know, and you don't have to know every one of these numbers. I'm just giving you a little sense of, you know, they go down to Egypt, and about 100 years after Yaakov goes down to Egypt, they're living in Egypt close to 100 years. Yaakov goes down with the children, and they're there for 100 years till Levi dies, and things were good. But something happens in 2332. The bondage begins, and then finally, unfortunately, in the year 2361 and .2, Paro comes up with the final solution against the Jewish people. So what we're going to talk about a little bit over here is this whole idea of assimilation and anti-Semitism today. And see the sources in the Torah. This is the first time you're going to be confronted with anti-Semitism. It's also the first time you're confronted with assimilation. So as we look in Parshas Shmos, gives us the insights to understand why there is assimilation and why there is anti-Semitism. We began to speak about it last week, but I don't think we got to that point. We just came to that point, but we didn't get to that point. To give you a context, somebody sent me an email yesterday, a South African as it was. He sent me an email sending me the link to a YouTube presentation. You're familiar with YouTube, I don't have to tell you. YouTube is people can make their own little videos, and you send it to a central agency, and you can send it to everybody. You want right now, you make a little video of us learning Torah. And just send it to YouTube, it's there. I don't know how long it's up there, but it's there, and everybody can look at it and listen to our class of Torah. So somebody forwards me a YouTube from one of these white supremacist groups. And this is, and it was one of our congregants, and he said, so how do we respond to this? Like, how do we deal with this? You know, so this white supremacist, he gets up and says, and one of these southern guys, a real jlob of a guy, you know, and he says, if the Christians or the Catholics or the Protestants or the Muslims would ever put a tax on all the food you buy, you wouldn't tolerate it, would you? If you wanted to buy some aluminum foil paper and you had to pay another nickel to give it to the Christians, wouldn't you be upset? Of course you would. Be up in arms. Seems when the Jews put a tax on all our foods and anything that comes with food, we don't say anything. It's a multi-billion dollar taxation of the American and the world consumer. So that's something going to grab your attention. What am I talking about, he says. Right? He says, do you notice when you buy things, there's these little symbols on the things that you buy? Did you ever notice? And he takes a cat. Do you like mayonnaise? Hellman's mayonnaise. He puts it up front of the camera. See that little circle? And a U? That, I didn't know what that was. So I called up Hellman's and I said, what is it all about? And this other thing underneath it says, you know, how did he mispronounce it? I can't, you know, Parveen for Parv. Parvee or whatever. And they told me, again, obviously this guy is probably lying. They told me that this means it's kosher. And I said, what does it mean? It means the rabbi came and he blessed it. And therefore, and we have to pay the rabbi to bless it. And I've done research. And you know, and then you go to other sites, and there's hundreds of thousands of kosher symbols throughout the world. And basically it's a tax. If you want to buy this product, you have to pay this tax to pay the rabbis and Jewish organizations. And this OU is this Orthodox Union of Rabbis, and they're paying them millions of dollars when you buy your mayonnaise. Okay.
We're sensitive, but
I'm saying, and he goes further. Mm-hmm. He says, I don't know about you, but why do we need rabbis to bless it? So he kind of says, you know, this is really extortion. It's like the mafia. You want protection. It's like the mafia. Don't you see the Jewish mafia? And he says, and look at the gall. He's ignorant, but his ignorance just fuels more. He says, and look, this one has two kosher signs. The O and the U, and this Parvi is another institution. Why you need two institutions to certify? There's so many more on the take. And at the time I looked at it, we were 9,000 hits. You know, 9,000 hits. And this is just one. And that, you know, and once I was there, so I look a little more, and then I find there's another one, a little more sophisticated. You know, okay, and we know the answer. You're paying the rabbi, not just the tax. We know that the rabbi has to go and spend his time and make sure it's kosher. And we could say in the Goyish term, healthy. It has a health standard that's better. And you're paying just like you pay the Food and Drug Administration taxes all foods. You know, you have to pay to see an inspector come, the tax on the food, it comes from the government tax, whatever. You want to make sure the food's healthy. There's a tax you pay. So Jews are willing to pay what? For the rabbi to spend the time to check it out. You have to pay him for the work that he does. No one's just getting the money and doing nothing. Right? But why am I bringing this example? I'm saying this is a clear example of blatant hatred and anti-Semitism based on nothing, and you wonder where this comes from, right? So I had to respond to the person's email. Anyway, so what? One thing I did do is when you look at these sites, you can flag them, and you could say that it violates YouTube. You're not allowed to put things that are hatred or pornographic or things like that. So sometimes you know they don't. You think they check everyone? You send it in a 30-minute thing. You think the guys, when they get it, they look at the whole thing. They just put up everything. If you notice there's something wrong, then we'll flag it and we won't. So I flagged it. And I said, it's got hatred in there. Now, they're not going to bother to look at the whole thing. If somebody says it's hatred, or they get two or three, then they'll take it off. So that's what I did. But, so the question is, so like, try to understand this. Right? Try to understand this. So let's try to understand this. So let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to the beginning. And this week's Parsha gives you all the insights you need to know about the sources of anti-Semitism and the threats of assimilation as they go hand in hand. So let's start with a famous Medrash on the final solution. Source number 2. Final solution, I have the words Yisro, Eov, and Bilam. So let's tell you a story. But first, let's introduce here. The Torah tells us that Jews lived in the land of Egypt and they multiplied. There's a number of expressions used, so they grew and they got stronger and they multiplied and they spread in the land. And the Jews became a thorn in the eyes of the Egyptians. So the Medrash fills us in a lot of details. And the Medrash says, as the Jews were growing and expanding and realizing there's a lot of Jews and they began to realize that they're part of the society, and they realized that the old generation passed on and now Levi is no longer here. And the old guard of unbelievable tzaddikim you're talking, you know, the 12 tribes were 12 pillars of the Jewish people. These were foundations resting on three pillars of the patriarchs, and then 12 pillars. And now the pillars are gone. The Jewish people now had to deal with a change. There's a change. We don't have pillars anymore. That power of the pillars is gone. Each brother was like an unbelievable dynamo. And slowly, slowly, each one died out, each one died out. What do we have left? We've got nice people, nice Jews. We don't have the unbelievable great pillars. And then we have tzaddikim. But not. So the Jews said, you know, we got to begin to strategize on a new way of making change. So here's a very important rule when you make changes. You have to, who makes the changes? Who should make the changes? And who should not make the changes? So the problem is a lot of times people decide on their own that they're going to make changes. And also, are the changes consistent with what Judaism says? So what happens? Number one, the Jews started saying, you know, why should we live in our ghetto in Goshen? The Jews lived in a part of Egypt called Goshen. It was a separate ghetto. Not in a negative way, not in a negative way. They all lived in that neighborhood. That was their part of town. Just as you'd say all the Jews lived in Thornhill while the Egyptians lived in Toronto. Okay, they lived on north of Steeles. So they lived in Goshen. The Jews said, you know what? Why shouldn't we live in Cairo, Alexandria? Why don't we live where the non-Jews live? And they could have had all kinds of reasons. You know, maybe our work is there or this and that. So the Jews already start leaving their little shtetl, and they begin to mingle with the Egyptian society. They get attracted to the Egyptian culture. They get richer and richer. And the Medrash says, so what did the Jews do? You remember when they went down to Egypt, Yaakov told you who to build a yeshiva, and they should be studying Torah all the time. So the Jews now were affluent, and they decided, you know, they got a lot of time, so let's go to the theaters. So the Medrash says exactly, go to the Medrash, the theaters, they go to the circuses. They do all these kinds of things. And what else did they do? Other Midrashim says they abandoned the covenant of circumcision. They started circumcising. They stopped circumcising themselves. The Jewish people felt that the way we have to deal with the new Jew emerging in the Egyptian society is we have to be more like the Egyptians. And the more we're like the Egyptians, the better off things will be. That's what they thought. They thought this is the new strategy. So the Medrash says something fascinating. The Medrash says, let me just find the exact words. It says, when Joseph died, the Jews nullified circumcision. They said, we will be like the Egyptians. When the Almighty saw this, he nullified the love which the Egyptians had for them and changed it to a hatred to the Jewish people. Okay. Hafach libam lisno amo. He changed their hearts to hate his people. And then what happens? And now comes a new king. A new king who will change the laws. That's what the Medrash says. The Medrash always, it's not just stories, it's giving us the depth of the simple meaning of the text. If you look at the verses, it shows it. The Jews got carried away with their wealth. They want to become part, they want to become powerful. They want to make it, we'll make a difference by being part of their society. We're going to mingle with them. We'll be like them. We'll do everything like them. And it got to the point where even we will no longer circumcise ourselves. And if we are circumcised, we'll do reversal surgeries on that. Right? Yeah?
You say, it says in the Midrash, it says, he made the Egyptians think, change their minds.
It says, hafach, the exact words are, hafach libam. Right. He overturned their hearts to hate them.
How do we know that he didn't overturn the Jewish hearts? Well, they weren't really, to not have circumcision. Because the prophecy is led to come true.
Right. Okay. You're talking. What about the prophecy of being strangers in a foreign land? Right. That's what you're talking about. Okay. There's a lot of factors we'll have to deal with, and we're gonna have to. You're asking a good question, Leonard, and we're gonna have to push it off a little bit. Leonard's basically saying it was decreed that they had to be slaves. It was decreed that this had to happen. So what does it have to do with the Jews? What they're doing? So we'll see. There's decrees. But the harshness of it depends a lot on what we do.
No, but I'm saying, he's saying that obviously he's putting something in the Egyptians' minds so they would push on the decree as well, okay?
Right.
So obviously he must have done something in the Jewish minds to push on the decree as well.
No, that's not true.
If the Jews lived in Goshen for 400 years, there wouldn't have been slavery.
No, so that's a good question. If the Jews lived in Goshen, there wouldn't have been slavery for 400 years. It depends how you define slavery. It depends how you define infliction. There's lots of definitions of the word. You know what? A person who really loves being in Eretz Yisrael and can't live in Eretz Yisrael feels pain and suffering without anybody cracking a whip over him. I'm sure Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who lived outside of Eretz Yisrael in the medieval times, he would write, Sion halo tishali, oh how I long for Zion. He suffered. He suffered what? By not being home. You know, let's say, you know, you had the South Africans, the children went on their own to go to Canada. Right? And they were doing well. They opened their business and this and that. But they could, but they couldn't come back home so easily. They suffered? Didn't they suffer? Mr. Parents? Mr. Homeland? But what do you mean he has a nice house? But he's suffering. Because he knew he wasn't where he belonged, or he was homesick or whatever. Right? So the Jews were meant to live in Egypt, and you could have suffered. Really felt, I feel terrible we're not in Eretz Yisrael. Of course, we have a beautiful Egyptian home with a view of the Nile River, and the crops are great, but we don't belong here. We wish for Mashiach. This is not the ultimate. Of course, we're giving tzedakah, and of course there's yeshivas, but it's not in Eretz Yisrael. And that would be suffering. And that would have been that would have been the fulfillment of the 400 years. And that's the way God originally intended it to be. In other words, God makes a decree. He says, one thing, you're not going to have the temple yet. You will not be in the promised land as a nation. Remember, when he spoke to Abraham, his own nation, he says, you're going to have a nation. And that nation is going to go through a period of time that's necessary for the development of the nation to not have what you're supposed to have right away. The Jewish nation was not founded in the land of Canaan, although it could have had they not made earlier mistakes in the book of Bereishis.
But he did tell Abraham that there'd be three stages of suffering. He said you'd leave into another land, and then you'd also get to torture towards the end.
But the inu al sam does, they'll afflict them, doesn't have to be a whip. It could be, I have to drive and I have to cover my eyes when I go through the street. It depends on the level of spiritual sensitivity you have will define what affliction means. A spiritually sensitive soul will feel afflicted, literally afflicted, by having to live with non-Jews who don't understand what Hashem is. And to live with them is already an affliction. You know, sometimes you're invited to a party and all the people there are mamish, they talk Lashon Hara. You now are, all about Lashon Hara. You don't talk Lashon Hara. And you're invited to a party, people who weren't trained about that, and you're at a party, and all they're doing is talking Lashon Hara. Don't you feel terrible being there? It's disgusting, you even have to listen to it. They didn't say anything about you, but you feel afflicted. But if you don't know anything about Lashon Hara, you had a great time. Boy, it was an amazing time, so much fun. You know what I found out? I found this, that, everything else. But at Tzaddik, get me out. But if you can't leave, so you leave. Now you're in Egypt, you can't leave.
Why can't you leave?
God said you can't leave till the time. That was the rule. Can't leave till the time. It's affliction. We have to live in a society that's the lowest of the low. We're not the lowest of the low, but it's all around you. And we'd rather want to be in Eretz Yisrael than do Torah Mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael. And we can't. That's an affliction. So, Leonard, it's all your perspective. And God says, and the fulfillment of the decree will be fulfilled on how your, what your perspective is. In Bereshis, if the patriarchs didn't make a couple mistakes, we would have lived in Eretz Yisrael for the 400 years. Living in Eretz Yisrael without a temple. And with the minimal amount of affliction necessary to fulfill the decree, but there are certain things we shouldn't have messed up on, and we did, and therefore we had to go down to Egypt, and we're not going to go over all those things again. So, but now in Egypt, it depends what you do. When Yaakov went down, there is no reason to say there had to be Jews being thrown in the Nile River. It did not have to be that way. It was because we make certain mistakes in dealing with new scenarios. We make mistakes in change, so now other things have to come into place to compensate for the mistakes that we make. And it's a big mistake for a Jew to think, what should the Jews have done in Egypt? They were wealthy. But every day you say, this money isn't important, this home isn't important. Of course, we thank you, Hashem, for what's important. Hashem, when are we going to go back to Eretz Yisrael? It's not important that I make it in the Forbes 50 or whatever they call it, Fortune 500, whatever. That's not important for me. What's important for me is I make it in Hashem's Fortune 500. Hashem's Fortune 501. 501 treasures of worlds. It's 501, not 500. You want to be part of that. That's what's important to you. And when you're living in Egypt, you have to learn to resist those things and develop under those conditions. And the Jew made many, many mistakes here. Many mistakes.
But did they all make mistakes? Yeah,
many of them.
So what about the ones who didn't make mistakes?
So, for example, good question. Thank you. I love you. Milton, you always ask the right question. What about those who didn't? So, for example, Paro says, you know, it's time you Jews contributed. Contributed. You know, you're here, we let you in, and thank you, this, but you know, people help out, you know, even though you stick to yourselves in Goshen, can't you guys help a little bit with the development of the country? We're building pyramids. We'd like some Jews to volunteer and do some work, please. So, the Jews said, fine. The tribal Levi said, no! We'll not. What do you mean? What has he got? We have no business doing these kinds of things. This is not for, we have good pronouns here. We don't have to go into the inner city. Whatever. Levi never worked. Never. They didn't get sucked in the beginning. And the entire sufferings, they never had to work.
But the persecutions didn't come until after Levi died.
No. The tribe of Levi. I'm not saying Levi. The tribe of Levi that lived later. The descendants of Levi. Oh. Never fell for that trap. Of working outside of what their own realm.
Well, that's
and they never were sucked into, and they never were slaves a day in Egypt. So not everybody suffered necessarily. But then there's another aspect. Once we're a nation now, the rules are different. God treats us as a nation. And if as a nation we fail, as a nation we suffer. And God has to, only God can make the double calculations of each individual within the nation, what has to happen and how it has to happen, but the nation as a whole. In other words, as a nation as a whole, the majority of the Jews chose assimilation as the way to deal with the new era that was unfolding. The minority said not. But we always go in terms of history and destiny as the God guides the next step of history based on what the vast majority are doing, or the trend is going. And Jews, as a, by and large, were buying into Egyptian society. That's what all the Midrashim say. There were exceptions. You're right. And from those exceptions, we'll see the salvation came as well. But the vast majority failed.
But those exceptions get punished.
You're right. Those exceptions, and we'll give you an incident of that soon.
Okay,
I'm not forgetting it.
Can I ask one more question?
Let me carry on a little bit. So now God causes them to hate them. Now it's not as simple, all of a sudden they wake up one day, I hate your guts. it's you start thinking in certain ways. You use your free will choice to, and you think, what are those kosher symbols about? Kind of funny. Oh, we got to pay some extra money. Oh, a tax, eh? A tax. Now that guy could think some other things. Oh, they must really want to be very healthy. And it's so nice that we know there are certain products that are healthier than other products. And there are, we know there are people, Muslims especially, will only buy kosher. Because, you know, it's halal. And it's kosher to their standards. And there's secular people who only buy kosher because they know it has a higher health standard. And they're willing to pay a couple pennies more because it's a higher health standard. And they can say, wow, we're good, we got the Jewish people here because now I know what are the real healthy foods and what aren't. You know, you could look at it both ways. So now, where does that come into your mind? You know, God pushes you a little bit. You know, to think this way, to act this way. It's, you know, the more you try to make them love you, God says, the more they will hate you. Like the famous statement the rabbi said, right? When you make kiddush on the non-Jewish society, which means you sanctify it, the non-Jewish society will want to make havdalah on you. Havdalah means separation. Oh, Egypt is a beautiful nation. We want to be like them. We're going to make kiddush. Vayir vayvoker, Paro was a wonderful guy. Want to be just like him. My son, the doctor. My son, the successful Wall Street businessman. And that's my Yiddish anachas. You're making kiddush over the non-Jewish world. They're going to make havdalah and separate you from them. That's the rule. And we look at the first story. It's right here. The Medrash spells it out. But it's more than that. It's much more than that. The form of the anti-Semitism will be so crazy that you'll have to come to the understanding that it's only Hashem who's directing this. So let's look at this final solution. Let's look at the final solution. So Paro says, he has three top advisors. Bilam, Eov, Job, and Yisro, Jethro. Here are his three top advisors. He says, you know, there's a lot of Jews over here. They're moving up in this country. There's a lot of them. They're just like us. The population statistics say the percentage of Jews is getting higher, and they're rich and wealthy, and they're in prominent places, and this and that. And you know, I've got a lot of political issues with other factions, other neighbors who are jealous of all the wealth we have. And you know, how do I know the Jews won't make an alliance with the enemies of the Jews? Can't trust those Jews. Why? They're such loyal people. Can't trust those Jews. That was very logical, by the way. They're the most loyal people in the country. All of a sudden, why can't you trust them anymore? Oh, you know, how much money they extort from their kosher symbols? It's a multi-billion-dollar business, these Jews. We got to do something about them. Right? So, Bilam says, this is what we do. Bilam says, kill the Jewish people. Make them servants, make them slaves. Kill them. Eov was silent. Didn't say anything. Yisro ran away. Those are the three advisors. So what do you have? Yeah. So Bilam, so of the three, who was really demonstrative? Bilam. He said, kill him. Eov said nothing. That doesn't help. Yisro ran away. So what wins the day? Bilam wins the day. Bilam was, even though it's one out of three vote, Paro goes with the one out of three.
He must have been very successful if only a fifth of the Jews eventually left Egypt.
Yes, it's true. Okay, the Medrash goes on and says what happened to them. Bilam, who gave that advice, he ultimately was killed in the battlefield against the Jews many years later. Eov, because he was quiet, suffered the sufferings of Job. And Yisro, who protested, he had descendants who would be great Torah teachers in the Beis HaMikdash. So, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter makes a brilliant observation here. He says, you know, if you look at this Medrash, you will see how unnatural the Jewish Holocaust was. This was the Holocaust. This was the first Holocaust. It was much worse than what happened in Germany. Because this Holocaust lasted 100 years. not six. The brutality was only less because they didn't have the technology. But throwing a baby in the Nile River is not nice. Throwing a baby into a wall of bricks to fulfill a quota is not nice. And you go through all the brutality, all the midrashim, the disgusting things the Jews had to go through. It was just terrible. This is a 100-year Holocaust. Okay, now that's terrible. And there were, who knows how many Jews died. So how did this Holocaust start? So, says Rabbi Sol Salanter, let's think about this here. What do you know about Bilaam in general? Do you know anything about Bilaam? What do we know about Bilaam in the Torah? What do we know?
He's powerful.
He was powerful in what way?
He
was a spiritual leader.
He's a prophet.
He was a prophet. The Talmud says there was no prophet like Moses except for one. Bilaam had the spiritual talents. He used them in the wrong way.
From the other side.
As Moshe. Okay? So now, if Bilaam hated the Jews, and he wanted to express his hatred for the Jews, what should have been his advice? Paro says, you know, these Jews are increasing like cockroaches. We gotta do something about this. We gotta stop it. How are we gonna stop them? What would Bilaam's, based on who he is, what should Bilaam have said? Not kick them out. He says, I will curse them. I will use my powers of prophecy and black magic, and I will pray to God that they shouldn't be a problem for us. He had tremendous, he was able to curse people, they die on the spot. He had such negative spiritual talent. So go to your corner, Bilaam, and daven to Hashem to kill the Jews. Or to throw them out, or whatever. Use your spiritual talent to be that venue to give harm to the Jews. He gives such an opposite of Bilaam advice. He says, we got to physically kill them. That's not logical. Wait a minute, that's not finished. Eov. What do we know about Eov? The Gemara says about Eov, greater what is said about Eov than what is said about Avram. By Avram it says, I know that Avram is God-fearing. By Eov it says, he was an ish tam v'yosher, a wholesome, straight, God-fearing man who stayed away from evil. That's who he was. How is it possible for him to be quiet when Bilaam says, let's kill the Jewish people? It's an anomaly. It's an enigma. What happened? He's like the International Red Cross. That's who he was. In his day, he was an unbelievable kind person. Unbelievable. And now he's hearing somebody say, kill the Jews. There's nothing to say. There's nothing to be. Well, at least the United States will vote in favor of Israel, won't they? And then all of a sudden, one day, they don't say anything. Everyone condemns. The United States abstains. What are you abstaining? You're the one who believes in human rights. And another one of those anti-Zionistic resolutions. It's an enigma. Okay? Yisrael. What about Yisrael? Who was a symbol of truth and righteousness. He was a priest from Midian. He was a cardinal. A religious leader. And he was a true. He wasn't a criminal cardinal. He was a real spiritual person. Looking for the truth, a truth seeker. Right? So you're right, it says he ran away, but you know, he didn't run away right away. You know, remember that famous story where Paro was worried about Moshe and he asked an advisor what to do with Moshe and they wanted to kill him? And what did Yisro say? Yisro was the one who said, you know what, why don't you put a crown and put some coals and we'll see what she goes for. So that means Yisro hung around for a while. He didn't run away right away during the first steps of implementation of the final solution. Although he ran later. So look at this. He has three advisors. Two are tzaddikim.
They're not Jewish.
Doesn't matter, but they're righteous Gentiles. Eov is a righteous judge. You know, picture man, whatever secular leader that you felt was a mensch in this world. I know it's hard to find a lot. You know, you have mamish, unbelievable, the Pope, the Halakha Pope. Chas v'shalom. The Holy Pope. The man of God. And he's one of the advisors. And you have Yisrael, the man of justice, the man of law and order. And you have Bilam, the man of spiritual negativity. He's got three advisors. You'd figure the two advisors would have said something.
I thought Yisrael said.
He just ran away. And
I thought the Midrash says he said, how can you got to show, what about the original, what about Joseph, and don't you remember Joseph? And that's why
those
he
were
ran
others.
Away. He was scared of himself.
No. That's not what, he didn't, that's not what this Midrash doesn't say this. And other Midrashim say, you know, he didn't protest violently enough. He didn't make real proper protests. So you figure, the Jews always said, listen, you know, things are fine with, you know, we don't have to worry because two of the top three advisors are good people. We don't have to worry about the UN. Most of the countries are Western democracies. They believe in justice. And there's so many Christians in the world. They believe in spirituality. You know, they'll understand a just Jewish cause, won't they? What happened when Hitler made his decisions? Did the Pope say anything?
No, he did nothing.
Were there big protests? The Americans? People of justice? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Did they do anything? People in England do anything? Nothing. Oh, the Mufti! The Mufti, that Russia! He came to Hitler and gave him this Eitza to go wipe out the Jews. It was the Mufti. He was the Bilam. But most of the world were nice people. And look what happened. So how could you believe it? So when this happens, how is it possible that justice didn't prevail? So the answer is because when God decides to bring a Holocaust, he does it in such an unusual way, you can't attribute it to normal historical changes. It's black and white, it makes no sense. Why? Because to get the message that God is bringing it. And when God, when God told Avram, Yadoa Teda, Yadoa, you shall surely know, double expression, that there's going to be Egypt. He says, Yadoa, you should know that I will enslave them, Yadoa, and Teda, and you'll also know that I will redeem them. And you're going to see it's my hand guiding history. And if you think about the beginning of the servitude that went against all nature, and you'll understand that it was only I who really enslaved them. And you know what you're also going to know? It's only I who's going to redeem them. And this is a whole different way of your secular person, a non-observant Jew, who doesn't plug God and say, you look at the story of Shmos, and you see, it's very natural. The Jews were there, and there's sociological aspects of the dislike of the unlike. And if people are strangers, you begin to hate them one day, and that's why they hated the Jews, and because of this, and this and that. You know, that's not how it goes. The Torah is telling us, anti-Semitism, hatred for the Jews, Holocaust come as a response in general, now there's details that have to be worked out. In general, to the Jew failing. And had there not been anti-Semitism in Egypt, what would have happened? It was bad enough that 4/5 assimilated. They would have all assimilated. We wouldn't have had that nation. Remember, what's the bottom line? The bottom line. There has to be a nation championing God. If that nation ceases to exist, the purpose of the world ceases to exist. And if the Jew is wanting to be like the non-Jew and he's assimilating, nothing will stop it. There's only one way. They got to hate us. They got to persecute us. They got to murder us. that we will be so far away from ever thinking again that we want it to be like them. You have to remember, this was, Egypt was the most advanced society of their era. The most sophisticated society of their era. The most. It was the United States of their time. Mamish. They developed so many things for their era. The pyramids. How'd they make the pyramids? How'd they make the Sphinx? These are natural wonders of the world. How did they do that? There were theaters, the whole idea of theater, art, the papyrus, all these things. You know, cuneiform, all these different big new techno, arts, all these things. We say in the Torah, first commandment, I am the Lord who took you out of Egypt through the house of bondage. Why repeat? Took you out of Egypt, of course it was the house of bondage. Just say, I took you out of Egypt. Was the house of bondage. To say that Egypt, which was the most civilized country of the world, was still a base avodah, a house of bondage. They still believed in slavery, brutality and murder. The first commandment, never forget, don't ever confuse advanced civilization for menschlichkeit. And that you ever want to be part of such a country. Because if you do, there'll be nobody left in this world to champion God in this world. Now the Jews were confronted with a challenge. Here is a very big nation. And it has all kinds of influence on the world. Let's get in there. We can influence the world. But what's the price we pay? We give up our Jewish identity to pay that price. You never pay that price. And if you do, here's the problem. And if God doesn't step in, what will happen? You'll all be finished. There'll be no Jews left. Be successful Egyptians, but no Jews. The purpose of the world will not be met, and for that intensive purpose, there's no need for a world anymore. And the world will ultimately destroy itself, as we see through the book of Bereshit. Follow? So now what is, God doesn't have a choice now. We put God against the wall. God said, okay, I'm not gonna, I love you, go ahead, continue to get richer, continue to shed your clothes, and give up everything, and be like Egyptians, and be as immoral as the Egyptians, and all this, and there'll be nothing left of the Jews. What would have taken another generation or two, there'd be no more Jews left in Egypt. There'd be nothing left of us! We've been happy! Nothing left of the Jews. So God said, I don't have a choice. You haven't given me other alternatives. What's going to have to happen is there's going to be a Holocaust, but you're going to see it was a God-directed Holocaust. How do you know it's God-directed? Because it didn't make sense. The advisors were pro-morality, were pro-religion, pro-spirituality. What happened to the voices? It just didn't make sense. And the Jews were, even the Medrash says, initially, they went to Paro, they went to Paro, says, you know, we gotta do something against the Jews. Let's start up against the Jews. Paro said, Are you crazy? Joseph was the one who got us rich. The Jews are great for the economy. Are you out of your mind? What are you worried about? They're good for the economy. No! They take a tax for the two kosher symbols. Gotta kill him. Don't you realize these are the minds of Wall Street? Don't you know Greenspan's a Jew because then the economy is doing okay? Don't you get it? Those Jews are good workers. They're smart. They bring in economy. What do you want? You want to destroy, you know, if you destroy them, there'll be nothing left of our economy? We don't care. We hate them. They take double tax on the kosher mayonnaise. It's logical. Why would you want to kill a Jew? They're the most, there's no records of us being cheaters and swindlers and crooks and this and that. There's no evidence of that. Well, we're in the theaters, we're in the parties, we're like all of you guys. God says, but it can't be that way. And any Jew looks at this is meshuggah, this isn't normal. God says, precisely. Now you see it's me? You see it's me. Right? And that's the problem. That's the problem. And why will a non-Jew think that way? Here's the real point. The Jew has to realize, remember we said this, I don't know if we said it last week, I don't remember where I ended off and what I said on Shabbos, what I said here. Paro said, you realize we are the wealthiest country in this world because the Jews are moving into our country. Mm-hmm. They are the reason of creation. Since they're the reason of creation, therefore every country they lived in was always prosperous. If you're going to get rid of them, you realize we're going to fail. We're going to fall. The Jew is receiving from Hashem through the host country. But it's God giving it to the host country to come to the Jew. That's the way it goes. When you're in exile, you don't get directly from Hashem. When you live in Eretz Yisrael, you're eating the food of the land. God makes it rain right on your land. You're getting directly from Hashem. When you're in exile, you get it through the non-Jew. The challenge of exile is to realize it's still from God and not from the non-Jew. And God says, you want me to take care of you? You be as a Jew supposed to live. No. I'm getting it from the non-Jew. When the Jew makes that mistake, that's the mistake the Jew made. Let's stop circumcising. Let's this, like that. Let's be like them because they're the one that are feeding us. Are you forgetting it's God? Then what do you think the non-Jew's thinking? Non-Jews, well, if the Jews don't even think they're getting it from God, what do we got to worry about? Right? That's the change that happens. When does a non-Jew really respect us, believe it or not, is when we live like Jews. Yes, there'll always be some people who hate Jews. That's always, but they'll never take control. There's always going to be some idiots there who don't want to be moral people. Of course, but that's not the majority of the world, necessarily. But the majority of the world, they go blow by the wind. That is the majority of the world. That's the majority of the world. So when the Jew lives like a morally principled person, the world sees there's morality. We'll try to live morally. There'll be those that are always a Molech will try to stop. You have to have some free choice in this world. But when the Jew himself isn't moral, and the Jew himself wants to be like all of them, so there's nothing special about you anymore. So then all of a sudden, somehow magically, they start to hate us. Why? That's the built-in safety net on the one hand, and also God making big course adjustments. So for example, we'll give you, I didn't forget your question, Milton. So Milton, you know, the questions you bring and the questions we say about the hunger, what about the little children? What about this? So you're not the first guy to come up with that question, Milton. You know who the first guy to come up with that question was? Moshe. Moshe sees what's happening to Jewish people. He sees that children are being thrown into the walls. Moshe says, Hashem, how can you do this? What did this little child do? Hashem says, Moshe, don't try to understand what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing. Don't interfere. Moshe says, but look, I'm watching this child right now. They're going to put a Jewish child into the bricks. They're going to put mortar on him. He's going to be a piece of wall. Hashem, it's a nice little Jewish child. What did he ever do? Hashem says, you know what? I'll let you have it your way this time. Go ahead, pull him out. Save him. Pulls him out. He saves him. His child grows up. Fine, upstanding Jew. Years later, he comes to the Jews, getting the Torah at Sinai. They're waiting 40 days for Moshe to come down, and some people are a little anxious, and he's not coming down, and there's a rabble rousing. We need to create an idol. Who is the one who created the idol of the golden calf that would hurt us for generations to come and we've never recovered from that sin? Who is the one? Who?
The
baby Moshe pulled out! That baby that he pulled out was the one who built the golden calf! And from that, millions of Jews have suffered from that. Hashem says, I know he's not to live. You don't know what I know. You don't know what his past was in his past life. And I know if this baby lives, it will be no good for us. And he's better off in his tikkun is to die right now. You don't understand. I'm a creator. I know what happened in the last 2,440 years till now. There's a lot of history that has to be corrected. You think you know better. I know what's better. And you know we're ever going to understand it. But here's one little sample. Moshe was no greater humanitarian than Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu, like all of us, how can you do this? I know what I'm doing. You are a physical being. You see pain. Pain is bad. Can't do pain. There is something called tikkun. There's something called correction. We don't understand how it works. You have to remember, in the book of Bereshit, we learned about four terrible generations that existed. The generation of Enosh that led the entire world against God in idolatry. A terrible, terrible, terrible generation that did unprecedented crimes against God and the world. Many people who followed it, and they died as corrupt and terrible people without any correction of that. And there was another generation, the generation of the flood, that was so involved in immorality. And many, many generations of people died without any correction to their existence. And then there was a generation of the generation of dispersal that championed murder. And they died without any correction. And then you had the generation of Sodom. Four generations, four epochs of history where people failed, causing so much damage to the world and to all those souls. There's souls and souls and souls of people who have not come to any correction. And there's millions of souls that have not come back to God. And mystically we're told the Jews had to be there 400 years, every 100 years, to correct one of those generations. And within those Jewish people were transmigrated souls of people who had no tikkun yet, no correction. And their only correction could come through the correction of suffering and pain. And that's what happened. God says, I'm balancing the books through the Jewish people. Let me do what has to be done. You don't understand. This is way beyond what you can understand. And you let one out, look what's going to happen. Can you imagine we'll let out more? Only let out one. I understand. You don't know. You don't know what it means of life, the next world, this world, sin, that. 4 years, if we would have made it the way we should have, and totally passed, then when we got out of Egypt, we'd have brought the Mashiach. But you'll see we failed. Let me just finish one more point. Just give me 5 more minutes. Let's finish the idea. One more point. But here's the other side of the coin. So you see by the total nonsensibility. You go to Germany. The whole Holocaust in Germany was so not logical. Was so not logical for Hitler, who was called the little corporal. Who they said he would never succeed in life. He was a nothing, a loser. A loser like that. And all the things that had to happen for him to rise to power. We don't have time to go through a history lesson on it. But it was certainly supernatural. How a loser like him becomes in a democracy. It was a democracy, the most democratic country in Germany. The most cultured society in Germany. Where the Jews had the most rights of anyone else. And in a mere 10 years, stars on every Jew. How did that happen? He was totally a lunatic. He was a loser. Anything he tried in life, he failed miserably at. But God put in his mouth a power of speech. And whenever he talked, people were mesmerized. And all the events that God makes a depression in 1929, and then the Germans don't have any food to eat, and there the inflation, and this, and that, and all those looks. But at the end of the day, how did this guy become the? And how could Germany, that was so cultured? I understand if this would be somewhere in Africa, somewhere in Arabia, but in Germany, where they're at the theater, where they come on time. They systematically, they just showed in 60 Minutes that the miles of underground information that they dealt of every person they killed in the Holocaust. So meticulous. They were so nice to dogs! And one Jew before he was going to get killed, they gave him one last respect. Treat me at least as nice as your dog, and they had to let him go. If you treat me like your dog, I'd be happy. The brutality. It's a prophesying, don't you hear it's from me? Ah, but if you hear that's from me, if that's from me, Yado, you should know I'm going to put you in slaves, but you should know that I will redeem you. And that redemption is just as much supernatural. If you look at all the events of the redemption, they were all supernatural. Number one, just a few of them, and this is Parsha. Moshe Rabbeinu is born, right? Who's his mother? Who's Moshe's mother? Yocheved?
Yocheved.
How old was Yocheved when he was born? 130.
130.
Now, even Sarah was only 90.
90.
130? She has a point. And even in those days, that was not usual. That was already, that was unusual. Right? She has a boy. Right? Number one. Number two. How did this, and Paro makes laws, every boy who's born has to get killed. And somehow this kid lives. He gets lives. They put him in the Nile River. And when they put him in the Nile River, the moment he's in the Nile River, the daughter of the king decides to convert to Judaism. Bisya, I'm going to convert. She goes into the Nile to convert. Her father is the biggest anti-Semite. And Bisya says, you know what, the Jews, I want to be like the Jews. And that's why it says she went down to the Nile to bathe. She went to go to the mikvah. And as she goes to the mikvah, she sees the baby. And they know it's a Jew. And all her maidens say, that's a Jewish baby. We got to kill him. So the major says, Amal came and killed all the maidens. And now, what she takes it to the palace. How is this? And the father says, what is this? It's a Jewish baby. We got to, daddy, I want this Jewish baby. And he was told by his astrologers, he's going to be born very soon. I said, okay, you could raise him. And then he doesn't nurse from anybody. So what do? They have to find, he only will nurse from a Jew. Who does he nurse from? His own mother. And he gets to go back home and get raised by his parents for a few years until he goes back. Now, is this normal? Can you imagine in Hitler's world? Imagine Hitler, if he would have had a daughter and said, I want to raise up a little boy as a Hasidish Jew. And he says, fine. Right? And then finally when Moshe becomes an activist for the Jews and he starts killing an Egyptian officer. And now they say, you know, this is enough. We have to kill him. And they want to kill him. They want to execute him. They want to chop his head off. His head turns to marble. His neck turns to marble. And the axe kills the executioner. And he's able to escape and nothing happens to him. And we haven't even begun to talk about the 10 plagues and the splitting of the sea, etc., etc. What is God telling you? Just like I'm the God who put them into the Holocaust, I'm the God who took them out of the Holocaust. I'm the very same God. And what name did she give him? Moshe, which means from the water I took him out. You know, it's like publicly saying, I broke the rules. She gave him a name, Min Hamayim Mishisu. From the water, I drew him out. So now when they know Moshe, whatever, his name is Moshe, meaning to say, I dissed you, Paro. Dis, you know, that's a new expression now, disrespect. It's a new term, you gotta keep up with the times, man. I dissed you. Daddy says, kill every Jew. This is the one we keep alive. That's his name represents, this is the Jew we keep alive. And of all the names, interesting, the Medrash says that's the name, Moshe had 10 names because he was such a great person. His parents didn't call him Moshe. They gave him, there were other names, I don't want to get to it now. But what name stuck? The one that Bishya gave him. Why that one name that stuck? There's a lot of reasons the measure says. But now on a simple level, because that proves more than anything else, it's God who saved the Jewish people. And who is this leader already? Think Moshe was any great sheikhs? Remember, they took him as the baby to choose between the coals and the crown, and what happened? He wants for the crown, and the mouth does what? He makes his take and he puts it to his lips, and now he can't speak. As a speech, a guy with a speech impediment is going to get the Jews out of Egypt. We're going to go to Egypt. Place, however he spoke, I don't know how he spoke. That's what I don't want to say. You know, you imagine Martin Luther King gets up. We have the blacks. I got a dream, and he's such an eloquent speaker, and we're going to get you out. Blah, blah, blah. And who gets to just be a guy who mumbles and stumbles and bumbles with his mouth? This is a leader, a shepherd. God is throughout the whole story. That you gotta get the, this is what the Parsha Shmos is saying. The whole Holocaust came from God, and the whole salvation came from God. And it's not, and that's the way Jewish history has to always be understood. Mm-hmm. From start to finish. And any other Holocaust that comes out, comes that way. And all the rabbis in the early 1900s, they all said that the greatest Holocaust was gonna come out of Egypt. Out of Germany. They all said it. The Chavetz Chaim, the Meshech Chachma, they all said it. It's gonna come from Germany because the Jews are now, they wanna be Germans. Berlin is Jerusalem. And if you look carefully, every terrible thing that the Jews did, the Germans came back with the same terrible laws. I'll just read one statement and we'll close with this. The Kelemer Magid said 60 years before Hitler came to power. You understand? 60 years, you know what that means? 1870s? There's no anti-Semitism in Germany. He says, the German will not persecute the Jew with ordinary run-of-the-mill persecution. When he rises to power, he will not simply oppress Israel. He'll make the hatred of Israel into a type of Shulchan Aruch, a code of law. Heaven save us, my dear colleagues. Impress it upon your hearts. Because of the sin of the Shulchan Aruch of Geiger, who was the founder of the Reform movement in Germany. He wrote a new Shulchan Aruch, Geiger. The Reform said we have a new code of Jewish law. A Jew in your house, not in the street. You don't wear a kippah. You don't need kosher. We play an organ. They wrote a new Shulchan Aruch. The Kelemer Magid said, you write a new Shulchan Aruch for the Jewish people? The Germans are going to write a new Shulchan Aruch. A new German version of the Shulchan Aruch is going to arise against the Jewish people, and there, heaven save us, it will be written. The only thing to do with even the best Jew is kill him. This was in 1870s. And that was with the Nuremberg laws. Precisely. This rabbi's not a prophet. He just knows Chumash. Where was God in the Holocaust? They said if there wouldn't have been a Holocaust, they would have been shocked. If there wouldn't have been a Holocaust. It had to be a Holocaust. It can't not be a Holocaust. Why? Because the Jew would prefer to live like the host. And thinks he's living from the host and not from Hashem. It's the wrong strategy. The Reform thought, how are we going to stop anti-Semitism? Let's be like that. And it doesn't work. So that, and you can live in Israel and have the same thing happen. If you don't know, you're getting sustained directly from Hashem. So this, Vayaka Melech HaRish, comes a brand new king. What do you mean a brand new king? It means a new law and order. There is one way to deal with the Jews, and also there's another way to deal with the Jews. And that's right after when the Jews come up with a new way to deal with the Egyptians by being like them and assimilating like them. And that's what Sefer, that's the failure of Shmos. You didn't live up to your name. We had to make adjustments in Egypt. We made the wrong adjustments, and now you're going to see, and God has to do it this way for us to learn. Now look, did you understand the lesson? You understand? Who is it you really want? Now, and who's going to save you at the end? When did Hashem send Moshe? Only after the Jews cried out to God and said, Hashem, you're the only one who can save us. Only then did he send Moshe. And then the steps began, but it was a very long process to get the Jews out. Anyway, there's a lot more to talk about, but we have to leave it at here. We should be Zoich assume that Hashem should take us out of the Gullus in the miraculous way, like he's going to take us out of Egypt.